Hello, I'm Andy Valeri, producer and host of Uncommon Sense TV Media. Welcome to this special edition of US TV, where we are here at the facilities of WYSO 91.3 FM radio here in the Miami Valley, public radio for the Miami Valley. And this is a special collaborative production between US TV and WYSO, where we are here with a very special guest, Mr. David Barsamian, writer, producer, radio producer, journalist of alternative radio. And David is here. You can hear his program, Alternative Radio, on over 125 different stations around the country, as well as right here on WYSO. David, welcome to the program.
It's
welcome
a pleasure.
To WYSO.
Thanks
you
for
are,
having me.
David is the author of over, journalist, author. You do writings for Z Magazine, Progressive, The Nation.
The Sun, yes.
The Sun, and is the author of dozens of books now of your compiled interviews with the likes of Tariq Ali, Noam Chomsky, Arundhati Roy, and
Howard Zinn,
and many others, and economist Richard Wolff as well.
Which, yeah, the new book is called Occupying the Economy, Challenging Capitalism.
Right, and we have
with,
a copy of it right here, which I wanted to talk about this because get right into it. Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. Tell us a little bit about it. And for folks who might not know who Professor Wolff is, who he is, and why anybody should listen to what he has to say, because you've been working with him on this book. So.
Yeah, I met Wolff about a year ago in New Mexico, and I was very impressed with his ability to explain economic issues in a very clear and transparent way, a very forceful analysis using a Marxist critique to talk about capitalism. Capitalism has been a taboo subject in the United States, and critiques of capitalism are basically non-existent. So I had been looking for a voice, looking for someone that could talk about the system in a very critical way, to deconstruct it, to cut through all the shibboleths and platitudes and cliches about, you know, the wonders of the free market and, you know, Adam Smith's invisible hand and prognostications from Milton Friedman.
Right.
And I was going to say Ayn Rand. They are connected.
Yeah.
Friedman was a disciple of Ayn Rand. But Alan Greenspan,
the
maestro, the oracle, you know, this great genius who didn't see the greatest economic crash in 70 years. He somehow just missed it. I guess he was asleep at the wheel when that hit him. He said it was a once-in-a-century occurrence. So I met Wolff. I was very impressed with him. And I started doing some interviews with him, and it occurred to me, why don't we do a book? There's, you know, really nothing on this topic right now, and it's very urgent. The Occupy movement had just started on September 17th in the United States, in New York at Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan. That was on September 17th, 2011. And so I did a series of interviews with Wolff. I approached City Lights Books, which is the imprint of City Lights Bookstore, the legendary Beat Bookstore in North Beach on Columbus Avenue in San Francisco, founded by the great poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And I had already done a book with them on Iran called Targeting Iran,
which we'll get to a little bit.
So I pitched this. I said, I got this great guy. He's really, you know, ready, willing, and able to do a book. Can we get it out? He said, not only will we get it out, we're going to crash it. That's a term I learned in the experience of getting this book out. That is to say, publishers have a list that they put out that this is what we're going to do in the next 6 months, and it's pretty much locked. You know, it's very hard to get into it. But the urgency of the economic crisis and the poignancy of this book as well really impressed the City Lights editors to crash it into the catalog. So it had no advance publicity. But it is now in its third printing, which for a small independent press in San Francisco is a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not talking about HarperCollins or Simon & Schuster that can, you know, publish 500 copies of, you know, the latest John Grisham thriller, and, you know, can pulp half of them if they don't sell. Right. So for a small independent publisher, this has been, you know, a very big book for them, and I'm really happy to be publishing with them because they have the kind of politics that I have and that alternative radio represents, you know, in terms of challenging the hegemonic thinking, the embedded ideology about, you know, capitalism and the economic system.
I find that when, you know, Wolf brings up, you talk about a Marxist critique, that's a word that as soon as you mention it, you know, it immediately creates a perspective that shuts people down, or, you know, they hear Marxist, up, bad, evil, or whatever, you know, it's the great political Satan. Having some familiarity, even more recently, having actually read some of Marx's works, you find that, like, why isn't this being better understood and more taught? And it's not in support of, you know, half the stuff in there I read is like, well, that's outdated or that doesn't make any sense. But there's some critiques in there that are very prescient and important to understanding the sort of capitalist structure. But as you say, that's sort of kept completely off the radar map of discussion in our society. And to produce a book like this, I think is the fact that you're already in a third printing on a small company shows that people are really needing to understand because you're not getting it. You mentioned Alan Greenspan. I think it's important to note that he probably was the most powerful person in America for some time when it came to policy, and it was a bipartisan affair. You know, so
it usually is when it comes to capitalism. And when Greenspan went before congressional committees, he would be treated with great deference. I mean, they were practically falling over themselves, genuflecting in front of the maestro, as he was called, the oracle, you know, this right. economic wizard and genius. You know, how should we think about the economy, oh master? Tell us, give us your wisdom. You know, what pearls do you have to bestow upon us? I mean, it was an appalling display of sycophancy and you know, quite disgusting. But in terms of Marx, I mean, obviously he wrote in the 19th century. Economic conditions are different, but certain things pertain, still obtain about the capitalist economic system. In particular, what he talked about, its werewolf hunger for profits. It is driven by the need to accumulate more and more and to maximize gain. That hasn't changed very much. I mean, obviously, you know, we don't have those kinds of what we referred to, I think, by John Stuart Mill, or was it Adam Smith, satanic mills, where literally they were like you would see these you know, almost medieval type buildings where workers were, you know, beaten and lashed and forced to work 12, 14, 16-hour days, 7 days a week. Child labor was common. You know, those things have changed, but the basic structure and nature of capitalism has not changed very much. So I think, you know, does Marx have something to offer in terms of a critique of the economic system? I think unambiguously, yes, he does. He should not be dismissed out of hand as someone who's, you know, somehow connected to the Soviet Union, which he had nothing to do with, by the way.
Right.
Again, they, you know, the other term that has been demonized is socialism and socialist. That, too, has become a very pejorative term. If, you know, if most Americans hear the word, or, you know, they immediately say, you know, Stalin or gulags or Siberia or, you know, the Soviet Union.
Right. Without understanding the greater context and even the American context to that word and that movement, and how so much in American history, particularly at the beginning of the 20th century, is, you will know that the socialist movement in this country in like the 1912 elections had, what, over 1,000 different mayors and council people.
Well, in 1920.
No, in 1912, I meant. 1912.
In 1920, Eugene Debs, the right. socialist candidate for president, was in jail
right.
under the Sedition Act because he opposed World War I.
And he received how many
US
votes?
Entry.
Like 3 million?
He received a million votes.
Yeah.
Also around this time, it's very interesting, there was a journal not coming out of New York or Berkeley, but out of Kansas, called Appeal to Reason, which had 700,000 subscribers, 4 million readers. You know, the population of the United States in that time, around 1910, 1915, wasn't that big. It was maybe 60, 70 million. So if you do the math, I mean, there's an extraordinary number of people being exposed to socialist ideas. It had an enormous amount of prestige at the time. It was the favorite ideology of many of the immigrant workers. And, of course, it had to be demonized. It had to become a term of derision and abuse.
Well, one thing, when you talk about the understanding, the nature of capitalism, and you talk about sweatshops, et cetera, probably an important point to raise, and something that you've brought up, has come up with your discussions with Noam Chomsky, who's brought this issue up about Adam Smith and Adam Smith capitalism and how what we're seeing today in this 21st century mass technological society has no relation to what Adam Smith was even sort of half no relation to what he was talking about, and that we're in a whole new realm of what we're understanding, this globalized system of concentrated wealth and power, which seems to counter the theory that most people probably believe they're supporting when they think of capitalism, the idea of diffusing a market economy and diffusing power.
Well, the fact of the matter is most people have not read Wealth of Nations. The only thing they know about Adam Smith is the term invisible hand. If you read The Wealth of Nations, you'll see that Smith is a severe critic.
Right, a moral philosopher, really.
Of corporate capitalism. Right. At that time, it was the East India Company, which was pillaging and looting in India, causing enormous harm to a very developed economy. When the British invaded India, I mean, they found things that they did not have in terms of economic development, including steel development, all kinds of things. There were lamps in Dhaka in Bangladesh. There was a highly developed silk and textile industry. You know, all of these things were shut down. Manufacturing was moved literally back to Britain. And then the Indians were left with having to buy British-made fabric. And here was a country that was the leading textile manufacturer. Adam Smith said in his critique of the savage nature of European power, particularly referring to India, that the masters of mankind, as he described these capitalist owners at that particular time, had the ability to see that their needs were particularly attended to by the state because of the influence that they had over the political system. So the Adam Smith that is sold as kind of this wonderful prophet of capitalism is not the one the record supports. But again, in a well-developed propaganda system, he's held up as a kind of icon for what is euphemistically called the free market system.
Right, we'll get into that in a moment too. And just one thing to keep in mind, which I find interesting about your work and the work, as you talk about the analysis that you do on capitalism, I think you have a very sort of special perspective on it because of your lengthy history in covering this and the fact that you have much of your journalism and much of your coverage has been global. I mean, you've been traveling the world for decades now, and you've spent time in India, Pakistan, Asia, the Middle East, et cetera. So you've seen, unlike for the general listener who, a viewer or listener who might be just tuning in and go, wait, what kind of crazy left-wing stuff is this? You've seen the actual face of capitalism on a global scale in the work, and where somebody here might think, well, this is my pizza joint that I'm running my business, and I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm trying to—
A job creator.
Right, and they're thinking, I don't want the government on my back, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all fine and realistic principles, but what you're really dealing with here isn't that. You're dealing with something completely different.
No, the capitalists don't want the government on their back when they're making money, But when they're losing money, they want the government on their backs. That's the bank bailouts.
Right.
That's saving Goldman Sachs, which should be, you know, many of its officers probably should be prosecuted for crimes against the American people and the environment. So they feign this kind of aloofness from government. But when push comes to shove, government bail me out, you know? I'm too big to fail. We got sold out, they got bailed out, is the slogan of the Occupy movement.
The adage, the sort of running joke about socialism
for the,
for
rich.
The rich and privatization
this
for the poor.
This is extreme in the American economy. Let's talk about sports, you know, a topic I'm very interested in. Professional sports teams, which are private enterprises, frequently go to town councils or state governments and say, hey, we need a new stadium. We need improved infrastructure. We need highways, bridges. We need to, you know, get our fans to the stadium. We need luxury boxes, et cetera, et cetera. And the implication, not explication, is that if this is not provided, we will move somewhere else. Like the Cleveland Browns left Cleveland, Ohio,
for that
to go to
reason.
Baltimore, Maryland, where they were given these kinds of facilities. Now, Arthur Modell was not a poor person, quite wealthy, the owner of the Cleveland Browns, just to give you a one example. Or Jim Irsay, you know, who moved the Baltimore Colts to Indianapolis because he got a stadium, he got a deal. They get tax breaks, they have all kinds of loopholes and direct taxpayer supported subsidies. They're getting, in many instances, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in order to make money. You know, this money is not repaid to the state or municipal treasuries. When profits are made by these professional sports teams, and they're very profitable enterprises, the management keeps it. The owners keep it, and the dividends go to the stockholders.
Right.
This is really existing capitalism, not the capitalism that's taught in economics departments at, you know, Dayton University or at OSU in Columbus. And that's the capitalism, the imagined capitalism. Then there's the real capitalism on the ground, which heavily depends on state subsidies and state protection. I'll give you another great example. The oil industry, arguably the most profitable of all industries in the capitalist economic system, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, BP, and, you know, Getty and on and on. They heavily depend on U.S. military support for access to those oil wells in the Middle East. You know, Chomsky and others have commented that if the actual price of the military protection, and it is a kind of protection racket, were factored into a gallon of gas, it would be anywhere between $10 to $20 a gallon. Is the more realistic price.
I've always thought that, like, the Iraq war in Afghanistan, but particularly the Iraq adventure, if you want to call it that, is like, why not pay for that entirely with gasoline taxes? Well, why take it out of income taxes and why take it out of everybody's, you know? Then you could have what is called true cost economics. We can start to get into where the actual prices of things, exactly what you're talking about with Chomsky, where you can get into the what is the actual cost that's being incurred to these items.
There's an enormous chasm between really existing capitalism and theoretical capitalism, the one that's taught in economics departments.
Right.
It has very little to do with reality. You know, these entities seek government subsidies. They get them. They seek loopholes. They have offshore tax havens which enables them to avoid paying taxes. I mean, this is, again, you know, it's nothing controversial I'm saying here. It's pretty well known how they're able to game the system. Because they have this enormous amount of capital at their disposal, they're able to hire the best lawyers, the best accountants, who can game the system.
And in the analysis that you do in Occupy the Economy with Richard Wolff, you talk about some of this and how this operates. correct, within the book? Because I haven't read the book. I've read a lot from Richard Wolff and
well,
from
there
you.
Let me just give you a couple of other examples. There's the case of Ingersoll Rand. They have a P.O. box in the Bahamas. Well, you know, it costs them $26 million a year to maintain this P.O. box. Well, why are they doing that? You know, is people going swimming there, or, you know, at the casinos or what, doing what? No, this allows them a savings of $40 million a year in federal taxes because they have this offshore entity. You don't even have to go offshore. There's the case of GM. There's the case of GE, General Electric, in 2012, netted, that is take home, $14 billion in profit. They didn't pay a single penny in taxes for that year because all of the profits were generated outside the United States.
How do you...
So the tax code, I want to say, is an instrument used to eviscerate the middle class and the lower class and to transfer wealth from the middle class and the lower class up.
Right.
So you have this massive disparity in not just income but in wealth as well.
How do you – now when you have a critique like this and, you know, again, going back to somebody threw out the word Marxist or socialist and all of a sudden you get – you know, immediately there's a sort of mental shutdown with a lot of people even though the principles involved here, the information, the principles about – equity, fairness. I mean, they're very, very American because if you go back to even the roots of the American Revolution, if the American Revolution was about anything at the time, it was about a rebellion against the idea that government was a tool to confer privilege on insiders, you know, and so now expanded the realm of insiders, and that's a whole other topic, but the idea that the king and a few cronies in bed with the government could manipulate and own the economy for their wealth, et cetera, et cetera. That resonates with people. People understand that. Americans of all stripes tend to, you know, yeah, we want a fair deal. How does your analysis and the work that you and Richard Wolff and your work in general, how do you see the way to bridge that ideological divide in order to communicate and get this kind of understanding and awareness to people who might come from a different ideological perspective or might be prone just to shut it off as soon as they hear something, oh, leftist or something like that, and they'll turn it off even though what you're talking about will resonate with them when they realize, yeah, you know, why am I being taken for a ride by, you know, that sports stadium or Exxon or something like that? What's an effective way to bridge that?
I don't think it's that complicated. I think it's rather straightforward and simple. You know, people are being taken to the cleaners on a regular basis. But groups below them are being demonized and scapegoated for their own dire economic situation. So it's not, I'm not going to blame GE for closing the factory. I'm going to blame the Mexican immigrants who are working in a motel cleaning toilets or, you know, working in a kitchen bussing dishes.
Right. I'm going to blame that. It's sort of the kickdown mentality. I'm going to blame the Mexican immigrant for taking my job, but I'm not going to blame the corporation for taking my job and sending it to China.
I mean,
you know,
what happens?
Like, so who took your job? The guy who shipped it to China and sold out your company, Bain Capital or somebody who closed your shop down so they could invest it in Malaysia or China? Or the Mexican immigrant who's trying to come here because his own livelihood was wiped out by neoliberal capital in, say, Mexico or something like that.
The evidence for income and wealth inequality is so overwhelming, you cannot even call it controversial. I mean, the documentation is precise. There has been a tremendous change in the U.S. economy beginning in the mid and late 1970s. You know, what happened? Something very dramatic. For the first time, Wolf is the source of information on this, since 1820, American wages stop rising. They flatten out. I was interested to learn this because apparently even during the Great Depression, that wages, people who had jobs, their wages would go up incrementally each year. Slight, but there would be incremental increases. Wages go flat. Another thing, that parallel things occur at the same time. Unions have been demonized, have been purged of all radical elements. They have become basically, the Gompers types of unions, cooperating with management. In this country, and this is a state which had a very high representation in unions, at its peak, the American working class was about 35 to 36% unionized. Today it's in single digits. Right. That's a dramatic development. What does it mean? I mean, not that you have to love unions, but it means that if I come to you as a worker, as you know, you're my boss, and I say, I need health care, I need dental care, I need days off, I need a paid vacation, I need a pension, and it's me against you. Now, according to this capitalist scenario, this is a level playing field. You, the CEO of the corporation, me, David Barsamian, one worker, you know, and we're going back and forth. You know what you tell me? Get lost. I got 100 people in the next room waiting for your job. You can either stay and work and keep your mouth shut, or you can get out of here because, you know, I've got these people who want your job. So, but if I come to you as a representative of a union, as a part of a workforce, I have much more leverage, obviously, than as an individual trying to bargain with you. And you have to respect that. You know, you have to, you know, you have to make concessions. Okay, you know, I can't give you 4 weeks paid vacation. We'll give you 3 weeks paid vacation. You happy now? Come back in a year. Let's talk about that fourth week. Let's see how, you know, profits work out if we're making enough money to do that. So that was a huge development, the loss of the unions. Even people not in unions benefited. And I know this is a concept which may seem a bit arcane, but if I'm a worker and I don't have a union behind me, but I know that, you know, the shops in the adjoining town have unions, right. You know, the auto factories, the UAW, the mills, the textiles, these other industries, furniture, have unions. They have things, pensions. They have health care. They have the things that I want. And they also, just by being there, it brings up the floor.
It's literally the incarnation of what was that Reaganism about the rising tide that lifts all boats.
Yeah, except they didn't tell you under Reagan it was yachts that were being lifted.
Right, yeah.
And all the boats were the canoes, the kayaks, and the rowboats that sank right to the bottom.
Right, the rise of unions in the 20th century. And Wolf talk, a lot of his work goes into, from what I've read of it, you know, he discusses that very phenomenon.
Yeah, about now let me finish about what happens in the 70s and the 80s, yeah, because that directly leads to the economic crisis today. Wages go flat. Unions start to diminish greatly in terms of influence and power. States pass legislation which makes it, you know, right-to-work states, makes it very difficult to organize. You have then massive tax cuts introduced by Reagan. You have deregulation also introduced, which allows this kind of unfettered predatory capitalism to run amok. You have outsourcing, where a corporation suddenly discover, hey, I don't need to be in Ohio. Who needs to deal with unions and American workers? You know, they expect so much. They're pampered and, you know, coddled. Let me move to Bangladesh. Let me move to Sierra Leone. Let me move to Tanzania. I don't need to be here. So you have massive outsourcing of what jobs? Not cleaning bathrooms, not janitorial jobs, but high-paying union jobs, manufacturing jobs left Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, Michigan in particular, and moved to third world countries in a race to the bottom.
Well, see, that's why this gets into then the perceptions that people have of what's going on and how is this happening, and yet how do you still get this level of working class.
It's happened in broad daylight.
And you still get a large scale of working class support, and anybody who works for a wage is working class support for these very policies which are eviscerating their ability to sustain themselves. Why is that?
Because of the politics of race and class. Race has been used as a tool to tame the working class, to convince the working class, the vast majority, that it's people of color that are pulling them down, that is, you know, that it's making it more difficult for them to make a living, to support their families. The other thing that's going on in this whole period that I'm talking about is the introduction of credit cards. Okay, my wages have gone flat. Prices haven't gone flat. My kids are getting ready to go to college. Tuition is starting to go up. I've got a mortgage to pay. What do? All of a sudden, I get every day in the mail, I get an offer for plastic, for a new credit card. So Americans start to go into debt on an unprecedented level right at this time. The other thing with unions is the very first thing that Reagan did as president was to smash the air traffic controllers union.
The PATCO strike.
The PATCO strike in 1981. And incidentally, I've just learned, I want to verify this, that the air traffic controllers union had endorsed Reagan in the presidential election.
A number of unions did. A lot of people did. He had a
And what was the response, crucially, of the AFL-CIO under Lane Kirkland at the time? Absolute silence. Right. A complete sellout of the unions and the working class in this country. Lane Kirkland was much more interested in bringing unions and democracy to Poland than he was to here in the United States. He was much more concerned about wages for Polish workers in Poznan, in the Gdansk shipyards,
right, yeah,
than he was about workers here in this country. I mean, that is an overt sellout, and for which his name will live in infamy, in my view.
Yeah, it was that gets into when we talk about the unions and the a lot of this now. You talk about the credit thing. And I find that's interesting. You bring up the credit bubble, credit cards, and the expansion of that. This goes to just a shift gear just a little bit, but it goes back to part of the systemic analysis that I know Richard Wolff has done. People like Derek Jensen have done this, and that is the inherent nature of capitalism dependent upon growth, and that it must constantly grow.
And the werewolf hunger for profits.
Right.
It has to expand. It's in its DNA.
It's in its very DNA.
Yeah.
And how do we have that kind of growth when you are in a finite world?
I mean, well, resources are finite. They're constantly being plundered and extracted. Fresh water is in short supply. Wars of the 21st century will be about water, in my opinion, rather than oil. We're still in the oil wars. We were in a period in the past where there were wars over gold, over silver, over copper, over minerals. Then it shifted to oil, and Ismail Saragelden, the vice president of the World Bank, warned the world that in the latter part of the 21st century, wars will be fought over water.
We're already seeing that. You see the problems in the West, in the internecine battles between states and the United States. You know, water.
Tell me about it. I'm from Colorado.
Right, Colorado,
which is a water-stressed area.
With California and all of the battles going on there, yeah, the attempts to come to the Great Lakes here in Ohio, the Lake Erie, and their corporations want to tap that, and they want to sell the water and, like, import the water from the Great Lakes down south. You've got the issues in India, the wars between India and Pakistan, strained by a lot of, again, we're back to the idea that it's religion and culture which is sold as a big problem. But actually, when you get in fundamentally, you start finding that water is a main reason for this. Israel, the West Bank, Palestine.
Yes, indeed. Well, also there's the role of extreme theology, fundamentalist Christian doctrine, which also supports the raping and pillaging of the earth with the logic driven by, if God did not want us to have those resources, he wouldn't have created them.
Well, and you've got the one representative in Congress. I can't remember his name, but it was a discussion about global climate change, and his statement was, well, it's not an issue because God in the Bible promised that everything will basically be taken care of, so it's not going to be an issue.
Be bountiful and multiply.
And that God will provide all this for us. And so, you know, scientific evidence is, you know, don't worry about it. This book, the Bible, tells us this. How that's – we're dealing with how do you deal with empirical information when you're in that kind of society? And that
well, then you're confronting magical thinking. And at some point, you have to cut your losses.
And
you know, I have a lot of friends that disagree with what I'm saying. And, you know, I can still like them. But at some point, I stop trying to convince them because things shut off in the brain. You know, certain ideas are not allowed to be accepted or to be, you know, acknowledged.
And that's the issue here when you're dealing now where certain ideas and information are not allowed to be acknowledged because we are in a society where this gets into something else that you've written a lot about.
And propaganda.
Propaganda and the use of the media. How is that?
Well, you see, the problem of capitalism is systemic. Let's get back to, you know, to the core issue. It's not anecdotal. It's systemic. It is structural. That's why it's constantly having these economic crises. Has anyone noticed since the first Reagan recession in the early 1980s that every subsequent economic downturn, as they call it, or recession, we're now in the Great Recession, going into its sixth year, by the way. Every subsequent economic downturn has been more intense and of longer duration than the previous one. There have been 16 or 17 since the end of World War II. So this is something that's hard to miss. You know, you really have to try hard to avoid drawing a conclusion that there's something inherently unstable in this economic system that is constantly producing these crises. And that, I think, needs to be examined and not dealing with cosmetic kinds of approaches to deal with a systemic structural problem. Capitalism is akin to a tumor. It constantly has to metastasize. To grow. It will eat its host, not because it's evil or it hates its host or, you know, has some psychological...
It's structurally dependent upon it.
It's in its DNA. It has to expand. It will ultimately consume its host. That is in its very nature. Now, is that sustainable with a planet, this pale blue dot in the universe, as Carl Sagan called it, you know, with finite resources, with a growing population? Is that economic system compatible with that? I don't think so. Richard Wolff doesn't think so. Most people who have examined the evidence, you know, with not through jaundiced eyes, but dispassionately, come to the same conclusion that capitalism is destroying the planet. It is, you know, it is looting the very resources which make life sustainable here on Earth.
But to people who do not, that statement right there sounds like it's out of left field or just off, you know, that's just to a lot of people out there who might turn on the PBS NewsHour at night or whatever and they get their news and, you know, et cetera, they're going to think that's just radical and extreme. Yet there are a lot of people, knowledgeable academics, journalists, activists, politicians around this country and around the world that would agree with that very prognosis, yet they're not the ones that you see on the Sunday morning talk shows.
They're not indeed. But I must say, I wrote a book years ago called The Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting. There's very little news reporting on PBS anymore. It's mostly opinion. It's mostly pundits sitting around a table talking about issues. I think this, I think that. They're not reporting. They're not doing any investigation. They're not getting dirt under their fingernails. You know, so PBS itself has basically lost that, you know, that essence of journalism, and it's mostly opinion. It's chatter.
Well, it goes into, again, the media thing, and we won't, you know, which has a whole topic unto itself, and we don't have time to get into it. And, you know, viewers and followers of U.S. TV media definitely know this is a topic we've followed
Propaganda runs deep into your heart, it will creep. A great song by
Buffalo
Springfield,
right.
Precursors of Crosby, Stills, and
right.
Nash.
And it is embedded into our information system because when you're talking about capitalism or markets, you know, and we're not talking about market economies and the exchange of goods and services. We're talking about things have metastasized to a level where society itself becomes the market, where it's not a market within, you know, it's not market economics within, say, a democratic society. You're looking at society itself is the market, where all exchange between people is all commodified by market quantification, where
and commodification.
Commodification of everything, yeah, including our politics.
Yeah. Let me get back to really existing capitalism, because there's a couple of things, you know, I want your listeners and viewers to know about, and that is really existing capitalism would talk about things like, where did the internet come from? Was it invented by Bill Gates?
Oh, exactly.
Or was it part of the DARPA program,
right,
at the Pentagon? Well, the answer is it was funded by taxpayers. It was developed at taxpayer expense. And then mysteriously is handed over to the private sector, to produce billionaires like, the Facebook CEO and Google CEOs and Microsoft and all the rest. Where did all of these vaccines and pharmaceuticals come from? Where did drugs come from? They're developed at the National Institutes of Health, right, all over in the United States at taxpayer expense, and then handed over all the research that is done and the results handed over to the private sector, who make a killing. This is really where did GPS come from? Where did the satellite technology that we're all depending on now to get access to the internet, to find out how to get to from Dayton to Cincinnati? That's all again the Pentagon. There's been massive avionics. Another example, commercial jet airliners that we take for granted. Radar, all developed at public cost and then handed over to United Airlines and, Southwest and Sky Blue and all of these other private corporations. So really, again, any discussion of really existing capitalism has to factor in these things. There's enormous public subsidies for these kinds of development. The interstate highway system, a lot of the infrastructure in the country, the airports were all built at taxpayer expense.
Yeah.
In this country. So, that I think is something that is occluded in any discussion of capitalism. Now, one of the interesting things that Wolf talks about, because a lot of liberals like to talk about reforms. Okay, capitalism isn't perfect, but we can reform it. Clinton never should have repealed the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999. That opened the floodgates for the kind of economic crash that we saw beginning in 2007. That is the blurring of the distinctions between savings banks and commercial banks. That became, totally like one entity. Everything became a casino.
And Canada didn't do that, and they were one country.
They were somewhat insulated from the.
Yes, they were, from, yes.
Yeah. Well, John Maynard Keynes, again, this great, liberal economist that Paul Krugman and others always invoke in their articles in the New York Times, he warned against this kind of casino capitalism, where you're just playing with other people's money. And it has the kind of the same risk that is taken as playing craps in Las Vegas, the roulette wheel. You could be a winner, you could be a loser. That was something that changed dramatically. Now, the idea of reform now is, that never should have happened. Let's pass legislation that will, mind, scrutinize, and regulate the banking industry, because clearly there are major problems. And so Dodd-Frank is passed, with great fanfare. Everyone's congratulating themselves. Obama is handing out pens as they do after signing some legislation, and people are nodding approvingly. But this bill, from the get-go, is full of holes. It's full of, ways for the system to be avoided, because the people that are designing the bill are in cahoots with the entities that the bill is supposed to regulate. That is to say, the banks themselves. They are on, they are getting campaign contributions from Wall Street, from the banking system. So you have, as I make this metaphor of, you know, basically the fox is designing the hen house. The fox is no fool. You know, he may design the hen house and take your money, but he's going to make sure that there are different ways for him to get into that hen house so he can have, you know, all the chicken that he can possibly eat. So I think the idea of reform is a bone that's thrown to people. The problems with capitalism are systemic. They are structural. They cannot be dealt with on a piecemeal basis. You know, a little rouge here, a little makeup here, a little, you know, eyeshadow here, a little blusher there, a little hair dye there. It's not about that. We're talking about a fundamental problem with the system. It is inherently unstable. Its constant predatory nature, its rapacious appetite to plunder and to loot natural resources, no matter what the cost. Costs are something that you have to worry about down the line. I'm not going to be here in 5 years. I'm the CEO of a corporation right now, let's say, and I have to maximize profit for my stockholders because they put me in here. They voted for me. If I don't, I'm going to lose my job. So I don't, yes, you know, I care about the planet. I drive a Prius. I'll recycle glass and plastic and paper, and I'll do all these wonderful green things. But, you know, that's not going to amount to a hill of beans because ultimately the planet is being destroyed by an economic system which can only loot and exploit and extract. We see that now with the tar sands. We see it with fracking. The examples of this kind of recklessness and dangerous behavior should be all too apparent, but with a media system that doesn't focus on these things, that focuses on Bernie Madoff instead of the system that produces the Bernie Madoffs. I call this the rotten apple versus the rotten barrel. You know, it's kind of pretentious to call it a theory. It's kind of like my idea. Okay, Bernie Madoff, what a horrible man. He did terrible things. You know, let's put him in prison. What about the system that produces the Bernie Madoffs and the Raj Rajaratnams and the Rajat Guptas and all of the other Ken Lays and
all the way back Michael from Milken, Michael Milken,
Ivan Bosky, you know. What about this system? What is it about the system that is constantly dysfunctional? You know, it's like, let me give you another example, which I think is very trenchant. You know, let's say I'm a dermatologist and you come to me and you've got this rash on your arm. I say, okay, you know, put this lotion on, come back to me in 2 weeks. Well, you come back in 2 weeks and yeah, the rash is going on this arm. But you know what you tell me? Now it's on my back. And I give you another lotion. Maybe this one didn't work. You know, take this and then take these pills as well. You come back again in another 2 weeks. Well, now it's on your buttocks. You know, it's off your back. Now it's on your buttocks. So if I'm a dermatologist, I'm going to think, you know, there must be something in your system that is not working, that is producing these outbreaks, these dermatological problems, and we have to not be dealing with the surface, but rather with the core issue itself, your very structure, that, you know, what is in your system that is toxic, that is producing this. The capitalist economic system is unable to deal with anything because of the political system that supports it, cannot deal with structural problems. They can only deal with the rash. They can only deal with this or that bailout or this or that crisis. They cannot deal with systemic problems. So again, as I say, you cannot have cosmetic solutions to systemic problems.
And when you're in a society where our ability to communicate with each other and understand what's going on within that society is controlled by those same forces, i.e. mass media, and where opportunities like through community media, public, you know, radio like here, et cetera, the ability to get information, or, you know, obviously what you do with alternative radio, the idea of being able to communicate and have information available for people to understand that systemic parameter that they're in order to organize some sort of effective response to it, that's kept off the table, because back to the media system and, you know, in the propaganda system, if we had more time, which we're running out of here, that's a whole topic to get into it itself. I definitely would want to recommend to anybody, our viewers and listeners, you've done a lot of work on this topic, propaganda in the public mind that you did with Noam Chomsky, your different discussions with, you know, Tariq Ali, et cetera, about this, the idea of how we have, you know, the consciousness in our society.
Now, well, control of information is fundamental to maintaining the capitalist economic system, as it's fundamental to U.S. foreign policy, which is tantamount to imperialism. You know, again, another topic that is taboo and cannot be really discussed in polite circles. Of course, it can be on the margins, but, you know, it's not a topic on the NewsHour or All Things Considered or Morning Edition or the Charlie Rose Show. You know, in those polite circles, you don't mention those kinds of words.
And that's why you get, you know, we much larger topic, but, you know, the crackdown on whistleblowers today in our society, you know, with this administration and recently, you know, the mass surveillance state.
The case of Bradley Manning, who's a national hero. If Obama had any cojones, he would give his Nobel Prize to Bradley Manning. He deserves it. Obama did nothing to earn that Nobel Prize. Yeah, he bombed Pakistan.
That all and all those issues, like WikiLeaks, pro or con, you know, whatever. But that's a serious debate. That's you know, we're back to the propaganda system, or you know, the conventional mentality that's just sold that, okay, they're bad. You know, that's just bad. Instead of like, wait, what is this about? What are we understanding? What is this? How can we have an actual democratically accountable society, and how can we actually deal with these problems we're facing today without information and the ability to know what's really going on?
You're literally naked. You're literally trying to form words without an alphabet. You don't have letters. So there's these concepts in your mind, but you don't know how to articulate them because there are no letters to string together. So the role of the media in manufacturing consent, criminalizing and marginalizing dissent, is fundamental to this system of control that we have and why we have the kind of outcomes that exist in this country today, where there's a military-industrial complex. Wall Street has tremendous influence over a political system that is just saturated and awash with money.
So where do you find, in our last couple minutes here, we didn't get a chance to get into India, which is a whole other topic, which is obviously close to your heart, and you went through your situation there. Speaking of media and journalism and the inability, I mean, this is a global issue and it's a global problem, the crackdown on people's
dissidents
and information and governments that do not want people to know what's going on, like with Kashmir, the neoliberalism going on in India and the problems there, and, you know, the Indian government not wanting people to, you know, you were kicked out of India and you've been going there for dozens of
times. Since 1966.
And they kicked you out because they just decided what? They didn't like your...
Kashmir to Hindu nationalists is what Israel is to Zionists here in the United States. It's a third rail. No amount of evidence or documentation matters. It's a visceral issue. The argumentation comes from solar plexus. It doesn't come from the brain. And so you get these kind of, extreme fundamentalist responses. You can't talk about it.
So where in the face of all of this, where do you find your capacity for engagement and, you know, to use that word, you know, inspiration and even hope or agency in addressing this? Because sometimes it seems overwhelming.
Well, I like to quote my friend and this great Uruguayan writer, Eduardo Galeano, who said, let's save depression for better times. You know, when things get better, I'll allow myself the indulgence of being depressed. But I don't think we have that moment right now. I'm inspired by people like you, people behind these cameras here today, you know, Brock and Jay, young people all over the country who have created the Occupy movement to a large extent, who have been working for years for peace and justice in the United States. I met an 86-year-old woman here in Yellow Springs, Mary Morgan, who has been, you know, for an entire life working for peace and justice. And she's, you know, vital and very inspiring. So I derive my energy from ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And as Howard Zinn says, people everywhere are lighting matches, a match here, a match there. You never know when that bonfire is going to erupt, but it will erupt one day.
And the great Pakistani poet who you often quote from, Fayez, Ahmed Fayez, about the word bowl.
Yes, speak.
To speak.
The importance of speaking out against injustice, in asking why, when masters of the universe are telling you to be quiet, you have to say, why should I be? I'm not going to be quiet. I'm going to speak out against injustice wherever I see it.
And engage the discussion and engage the debate, however, wherever. And that's what we try to do here. That's what media needs to be in a society. It should not be a megaphone for a few really wealthy corporations to decide what's being said. It should be a people's ability to have access to information and be able to have discussions.
Well, that's why, you know, unsolicited commercial, why Uncommon Sense TV is so valuable, because it does provide that space for dissident information.
And it's why the work you do is so important. It's why facilities like where we're at right now, WYSO, is such an important community resource, because it's literally here for community voices and the voice in and out and information you're not going to get from every perspective. On that note, David, thank you for being here. Hey. Thank you for being on here on USTV Media and joining us here at WYSO. And thank you and the viewers for tuning in or listening in to this special conversation with David Barsamian of Alternative Radio. You find his books, his writings, and numerous publications, many books, and of course, alternativeradio.org. You can hear it right here on WYSO, stations across the country, or alternativeradio.org is the website, of course. And of course, you can, ustvmedia.org, if you want more information about this program, just go there or contact me, Andy Valeri, at info@ustvmedia.org. I want to thank WYSO. I want to thank Nina Ellis and Peter Hayes for all their support, and especially Juliet Fromholt, the technician, the woman who makes it all happen here at WYSO. Special thanks to Juliet. And, of course, special thanks to the USTV Media crew, Jay, Brock, and Joe, who helped out so much in here making this happen. So, again, David, thank you, and thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Until next time, don't forget to pass it on.